Good afternoon and welcome to the ITRC PFAS team roundtable. This is session three. We encourage you to use the Q&A pod to report any technical issues, audio problems, or also participate in submitting questions throughout the time. I would like to welcome Kate Emma Schlosser from New Hampshire Department of Environmental Services, who will be your moderator today. Welcome, Kate Emma.
Hi, thank you, Nicole. And thank you, everyone, for joining us today. On behalf of the Interstate Technology and Regulatory Council, known as ITRC, welcome to today's PFAS Roundtable Session 3, Treatment Technologies and Aqueous Film-Forming Foam, or AFFF. As Nicole said, I'm Kate Emma Schlosser, joining from the New Hampshire Department of Environmental Services. I'm currently a co-leader of the ITRC PFAS team, along with Sandra Goodrow from the New Jersey Department of Environmental Protection. So our session today is sponsored by ITRC and hosted by the US EPA Cleanup Information Network, which is also known as CLUIN. So to go over today's agenda, first I'm going to introduce ITRC and the PFAS resources that are available from the website. Next, we'll review the format for today's roundtable topics, and then we're going to move into the bulk of our session today, the questions and the answers with our expert panelists. So ITRC, today's sponsor, is a program of the Environmental Council of the State, which is also known as ECOAST. We're a state-led organization, and we're composed of over 1,000 individual members from state agencies, federal government, the private sector, academia, and community stakeholders. Our members participate in technical teams which produce tools, resources, and training courses, such as the session you're attending today. ITRC's goal is to advance the use of innovative environmental technologies and approaches, and ITRC's work translates good science into better decision-making. If you'd like to be a part of ITRC, please visit the website. On the website, you can register to join our team, including our PFAS team, and you can learn about how to become an active member. You're welcome to use the ITRC materials available on the website, but if you use them, we ask that you review the disclaimer or policy that you can find on the website and be sure to credit ITRC. We note that ITRC is partially funded by the U.S. government, and neither ITRC nor the U.S. government warranty the material or endorse any specific products. So this past year, ITRC published a several hundred page per- and polyfluoroalkyl substances, or PFAS, technical and regulatory guidance document. You'll hear us today talk about the tech reg or the guidance document. This information you can see here on the slide also included a series of fact sheets, and we prepared 10 training visual modules on the content of the guidance document. The resources were prepared by our team, which is composed of more than 500 different professionals. And for a quick reference, you can take a look on the slide for the overview of topics that are in the guidance document. You can view the guidance document on the web, or you can even download the entire document as a PDF. Given all the ever-emerging science around PFAS, our team is working very hard right now to update the guidance document, and we're hoping to publish updates in both June and December of 2021. So in addition to the guidance document, we also have several external files that you can access with additional detailed information associated with the topics in the guidance document, including a comprehensive table that describes available treatment technologies, many of which I hope we'll take questions about today. There's also a table that summarizes regulatory values for PFAS in water and soil, which our team currently works on updating about every 4 to 6 weeks or so. So today's roundtable is focused on PFAS treatment technologies for solid and aqueous matrices and AFFF. So as indicated in the registration, our conversation today is designed to address specific questions about the content of the guidance document and training materials with the expectation that you, our participants, are generally familiar with the topic areas. If you want to navigate to these resources during today's discussion, there's a link to the ITRC PFAS webpage in the related links pod. If you submit a question that isn't addressed in the current document, please note that our team will consider addressing that information as feasible in the upcoming document revisions. ITRC has hosted and will host other roundtables to address questions related to other topics from the guidance document. So if you have questions about those other topics, please provide your input on the feedback form at the close of today's session. And I'll note that the prior roundtables are also available to you from the archive on CLUIN. So please take a look at that. You can see the recordings and the digest. And then please accept our invitation to join us for our next scheduled roundtable in June. Okay, so let's review some logistics for today. We do expect to fill our 2-hour time allotment. During our session, all participants other than the panelists will stay on mute for the duration of the session. We are recording the event for you to access at a later time from the CLUIN training page. If you'd like a copy of the slides, you can download them from the CLUIN training page. You can also access the slides by going to the related links section, click on the CLUIN training page, and then click the Browse To button. If you have technical difficulties, please try to request support using the Q&A pod that you can see on your screen. And then lastly, at the end of the session, please provide your thoughts about our roundtable on the online feedback form. That's going to help us improve our future sessions. And in addition, by completing the feedback form, you'll be able to certify that you participated today, and we can issue a certificate of attendance to you. So for today's format, I'm going to be reading the questions, and the panelists will provide their responses. I'm going to start with questions that were submitted in advance during registration. I'm also going to include some questions that we've received during prior ITRC PFAS training classes. But even with those questions, we really do encourage you to actively participate today. So please use that Q&A pod on your screen to type in a question, and then I can ask them of the panelists. Again, please try to keep the questions focused on today's topics, and note that our panelists are going to be focusing their responses based on the content of the guidance document. We are going to try to get through as many questions as we can in this session, though given our 2-hour limit, we might not get through all the responses, but we will be preparing a digest of the questions and answers, and it will include some references to the guidance document, and we plan to make that available to you on the website in the weeks following the session. So without further ado, I'd like to introduce today's panelists. All of them have been active members of ITRC's PFAS team over the years, and they've dedicated many hours to develop our PFAS guidance document, and they've supported or served as volunteer trainers for ITRC. So a very special thank you to our panelists for participating today. So please join me in welcoming Cliff Shirk of the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency, Richard Spies from the Vermont Department of Environmental Conservation, Shalene Thomas from Wood, Michelle Creamy of Clarkson University, Jennifer Field from Oregon State University, and Bill DiGiuseppe of Jacobs. If you'd like to read more about their areas of expertise, you can access their bios from the related links pod on the CLUIN training page. So with that, I'd like to jump right into the heart of today's agenda. Again, there's that Q&A pod on the bottom of your screen, so use it at any time, please, to type in any additional questions. We have pulled together a couple slides to help support some of the responses to the questions. So as warranted, we'll try to flip between those during the session. And just a reminder that the document actually has an extensive acronym list. And in case we start rattling off abbreviations for PFAS or other acronyms that you're not familiar with, feel free to jump over to the document and look at that acronym list to support our conversation. So we are going to start with some questions about AFFF, and what I'd like to do is invite Shalene on for the first question. Shalene, can you come off of mute?
Good afternoon. Can you hear me?
Hi, Shalene. Thank you for joining us today. So our first question for you is, are PFAS still used in firefighting foams? And if so, which types of foams contain PFAS?
Well, that's a very good question. So some, but not all, Class B foams do contain PFAS. And there's a good illustration here that is Figure 3.2 in our technical regulatory document. And it's really a good way to visualize this. Class B firefighting foams, they are commercial surfactant solutions, and they are designed and used to combat Class B flammable fuel fires. So anytime you have a Class B flammable fuel fire, you want to ask that question if PFAS is part of that mixture. All Class B foams, however, are not the same, so just because it's a Class B foam does not mean that it contains PFAS. Those on the left listed here in the figure are those that contain PFAS. Those on the right are those that do not contain PFAS. Although not usually categorized this way from a fire protection viewpoint, they can be divided into two broad categories from a PFAS perspective, so fluorine-free foams on the right and fluorinated foams on the left. This figure does illustrate that the types of foam classes that are part of the Class B family of foams and gives you a good indication of what to look for. Most major manufacturers make both fluorine-free foam and fluorinated foams, so brand alone does not really dictate if a foam is fluorinated or not. ITRC's efforts to date and the panel today will focus primarily on AFFF.
Thank you, Shalene. I want to invite Richard to come on for a follow-up question about AFFF. Richard, welcome to today's session.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Great. So as Shalene just introduced a couple different types of foams, and she's talking about AFFF, and our work has focused on that. Can you tell us, do all AFFF contain PFAS?
Sure. The short answer is yes, all AFFFs contain PFAS. However, they're complex mixtures, and depending on how they're manufactured or the manufacturer itself, they can have different types of PFAS in the AFFF. The AFFF is synthesized by combining hydrocarbon foaming agents with fluorinated surfactants, and it makes a product that is used to suppress petroleum fires at military installations, airports, refineries, bulk storage facilities, chemical manufacturing plants, and also fire departments use them often. If you go to figure 3.3 in our tech reg, we have a general breakdown on what's inside of a 3% concentrate of AFFF. Like so many products, it's a lot of water, also about 60%. With about 20% solvents, a very small percentage of proprietary additives and modifiers, 15 to 18% surfactants, and less than 2% are the fluorosurfactants. And it's these fluorosurfactants that have the PFAS in them.
Great. Thank you, Richard. Okay. Thanks, Richard. Thanks for linking us to that reference in the tech reg, too. For our next question about AFFF, I'd like to invite Jennifer Field to today's roundtable.
Good morning.
Hi, Jennifer. So Richard was just talking about the different PFAS mixture, and we know that the mixture might vary by the manufacturer formulation. So can you provide information about what PFAS were used or are used in firefighting foams? Like, for example, there's PFOA, perfluorooctanoic acid, PFOS, perfluorooctane sulfonate. We commonly see those in our environmental investigations. Are those compounds ingredients in foam?
Yeah, and we have to think about, you know, the foams that were used in the past, and then we now have foams that were requalified in 2015 according to different criteria. So in terms of understanding what the chemical composition was of AFFF used historically, there are good literature sources that are cited in the ITRC documents. Bakke et al., for example, unfortunately gives the information and the supporting information, but you can actually see a detailed breakdown of the chemical composition of the 3M chemistries. There's five examples, or maybe six, and then there's single examples of the fluorotelomers, and you can find pretty decent detailed quantitative information. But there's also papers by D'Agostino and Chow et al. That are providing information on the chemical composition, and a new paper that is speaks to the chemical composition of mil-spec AFFF that are currently listed on the QPL, or the Qualified Products List. In terms of what's inside of those documents is indeed 3M chemistry was dominated by PFOS, and so you see very high quantity, gram per liter quantities. What's interesting to note is up until now, our understanding is that PFOA is only 1/100th the level of PFOS in an AFFF foam made by 3M. In our limited information on fluorotelomers, we know that at least the ones we have listed in publications, you don't see PFOS. But you should see really small levels of carboxylates, and you might see minor levels of, say, telomer sulfonates. And that's because in the fluorotelomer foams, it's really other PFASs, precursors, you might think of them that way, that really dominate and are the active ingredients in those formulations. And so today we have mil-spec and we have non-mil-spec as well. And I think we know a lot less about the non-mil-spec AFFFs in terms of their chemical composition. But in terms of the DoD and the FAA, the military specification that is currently in place is stipulates performance specifications, and it currently requires fluorinated surfactants, but there is a maximum of 800 part per million allowed for PFOS and PFOA.
Thanks, Jennifer. And just for a reminder for our audience today, if you want to follow along with some of the sections that we're talking about, Section 3 of the TechReg document is focused on AFFF, and I think you can find links to some of the references that Jennifer just mentioned. Before we get too deep into AFFF, I want to stop and welcome in our panelists on treatment, and I'd like to invite Cliff Shirk to join us.
Hi, Kate Emma.
Hi, Cliff. Cliff, what proven technologies are currently available for water treatment? And more specifically, is pump and treat the only proven groundwater remedy at this time?
Well, the ITRC guidance document contains descriptions of proven groundwater treatment technologies, and I think we'll touch on quite a few of these during the rest of this roundtable. The two most widely implemented technologies for water treatment are GAC and IX, or granular activated carbon and ion exchange, and these are commonly utilized in drinking water systems, which you could argue qualify as pump and treat systems too. Reverse osmosis is also an effective treatment method for water. And so while there are no destructive groundwater remedies that have been demonstrated at full scale, in-situ sequestration with injected colloidal activated carbon is a field demonstrated alternative to pump and treat for addressing groundwater. But in terms of treatment, and I'm using air quotes here on treatment, which you can't see, of course, but because other traditional remediation techniques like excavation and disposal don't technically treat the source. So these are currently the only field scale options being utilized as of now.
Thanks, Cliff. I wish we do have video today so we could have seen your air quotes, but appreciate the visual. I just want to add on the slide, you can see an example of the technologies table that's included as the attachment to the TechReg. I know it's a little hard to see the font on here, but there's a lot of great information. So we encourage you to head there and take a look if you're looking for more information about the technologies we're going to be talking about. And so to get a little more specific, I'd like to invite Bill on. Bill, are you able to come off of mute?
Yeah, I should be here.
Hi, Bill. Bill, are there effective on-site treatment technologies that are currently available for soil, or are the remedial approaches limited to excavation and off-site disposal, like Cliff just mentioned?
Well, the field-demonstrated approaches that have been done at a number of sites include excavation and off-site landfilling or incineration and soil stabilization. Of those, obviously, stabilization can be conducted fully on-site. Soil washing has been performed successfully, but at limited field locations and mostly overseas, and I'd say which could be done on-site. And thermal desorption, which could be done on-site, shows promise, but for now it's only been done at the bench and sort of small-scale field pilot. But there are some thermal desorption projects scheduled to be done this coming year. And I would add, a question came into the Q&A about incineration and about the limited analytical suite or capabilities. The EPA has been working diligently on coming up with sampling methods and analytical methods for off-gas related to incineration to understand that better. And we have some more information potentially coming up later in this session about that.
Thanks, Bill. Okay. I think we'll introduce Michelle right now. Michelle, if you're able to join today's session.
Hi, Kate Emma.
Hi, Michelle. So let's stick with treatment technologies for this question. What innovative or new technologies are being developed, and how far along are these approaches?
Well, some new and innovative technologies for treating groundwater include use of advanced sorptive media that have very high sorption capacity, or even some sorptive media that can target particular types or compounds of PFAS. Also, some aggressive treatment approaches that rely on thermal destruction or free radical-based processes to destroy PFAS are advancing, although it is important to note that not all free radical approaches are effective at degrading PFAS. Many of the technologies that I just mentioned and others are coming down, that are coming down the pipeline are introduced in the ITRC guidance document, so you can see them introduced there. But there's lots of additional references that are provided that you can dive into for further detail.
Great. Thank you, Michelle. And I want to thank our participants today for keeping these questions coming into the Q&A pod. As Bill mentioned, there was one that we just tried to respond really quickly to. So keep them coming. We're going to try to keep incorporating them as today's session goes on. And we're actually receiving a few questions about AFFF composition. And I'd like to direct this to Jennifer. Jennifer, can you please describe the two primary manufacturing processes for PFAS and AFFF? And as part of your response, can you please comment whether AFFF manufactured by different processes has different mixtures of branched and linear isomers?
Yes, I'm happy to do that. So the fluoro surfactants and AFFF formulations can be produced by two sort of generic, general processes. So we have electrofluorination process that was primarily employed by 3M, and then we have fluorotelomerization. And there's actually a number of pathways by which one can achieve fluorotelomer-based chemistries. So the electrofluorination chemistry was a really complex process. It took a complex branched and linear feedstock and transformed it into a fluorinated chemical mixture. And so what you end up with is a branched and linear mixture. It, right out of the bucket, so to speak, or the manufacturer, branched are about 25%, linear about 75%. And it's a very characteristic feature of ECF-type chemistry. And that's true for PFAS. You see that signature in PFAS in all of its homologs. You also see it in the carboxylates, but remember, they're a lot lower in concentration, at least of the ones we've analyzed. But also things like the acetic acids, which people measure, and some of the amides, they also bear the branched and linear signature of the electrofluorination process. And do recall that the ECF-based process for AFFF was phased out. Those chemistries were largely phased out in 2002. On the other hand, the fluorotelomer process, it does not create quite the complex mixtures. It's a little bit cleaner chemistry, a little bit more focused on the products that it makes. So, you know, for example, the chemistries you see on the slide right now, that tail is only linear. And so it's a real big difference between electrofluorination and fluorotelomerization processes in terms of the branched and linear signatures. The chemistries you see in the slides now, those are all linear, and they will also only transform to linear transformation products.
Thanks, Jennifer. And actually, I want to go back for a second. You had just mentioned ECF-based AFFF formulations that had been phased out of production. Those that were phased out roughly 20 years ago or so, now they're called legacy AFFF, I think is the term that we use. Is that correct?
Well, I'm sure there's a lot of terms out there. I think I use that term when I think about sure. The ones that were used, you know, up to 20 years ago. But, you know, we didn't have AFFF requalified or reformulated to meet the new lower limits until 2015. So it kind of depends. If you can call legacy, you know, up to 2015 and then 2015 and after the newly requalified that are currently on the mil spec.
Great. Thank you for that. So, Shalene, I'd like to talk to you and continue with the questions about AFFF composition and specifically talk about some of the telomer-based foams. So can you further describe the telomer-based foams and please comment about how these formulations might have varied over the past few decades of AFFF use?
So certainly. So the fluorotelomerization process, it produced, as Jennifer said, mainly linear isomers with even number of carbon chains as the major products. They have been manufactured since the 1970s, so there are legacy fluorotelomer products as well as modern fluorotelomer products, terminology that we use in the TechReg document. The nomenclature includes N:2 fluorotelomers, so N represents, of course, the perfluorinated carbon chain length, and 2 represents, as Jennifer mentioned, the non-fluorinated ethane attached to the functional groups, such as alcohols, carboxylates, sulfonates, et cetera. So fluorotelomers are predominantly produced in 4-2, 6-2, 8-2, and 10-2 carbon chain lengths, although we have seen 12-2 in some mil-spec AFFF. In looking at modern fluorotoluene AFFF, it was developed in response to the US EPA 2010-2015 voluntary PFOA stewardship program. Most foam manufacturers now produce that short-chain modern fluorotelomer-based fluorosurfactant. And these modern fluorotelomer AFFFs are commonly called C6 foams. They do not contain or break down in the environment to PFOS or PFOA. They're currently considered to be less toxic and have a reduced bioaccumulative potential compared to the long-chain or legacy counterpart foams. That said, under particular environmental conditions, you can have breakdown products of these C6 modern fluorotelomer foams. And those breakdown products can include perfluorohexanoic acid, or PFHXA, perfluoropentanoic acid, or PFPEA, and 5,3-FTCA, or 5,3-fluorotelomer carboxylic acid. We do see that. So modern fluorotelomer AFFFs may contain also something very important to note, trace levels of PFOA and PFOA precursors as unintended manufacturing impurities or byproducts. So that's always important to note as well.
Thanks, Shalene. I would just invite, sorry, if you want to keep going or if Jennifer wants to add anything there.
No, I think that's a great summary. Thanks, Shalene.
Thanks. And I will just add, too, for our participants, if you're looking for more information about the nomenclature, Shalene just and Jennifer have talked about the fluorotelomers, you can head to Section 2 of the guidance document. There's also information about the PFOA stewardship program in Section 2. And hopefully you can also head to the references and the acronyms if you're trying to follow along with some of our abbreviations that we might spill out a little bit faster than normal conversation would allow for. So Jennifer, my next question for you, for those PFAS reported on a target analysis, say there's 15 or 30 different PFAS, depending on the method in the lab, are there typical PFAS that would also be found in AFFF formulations? And if so, what are those PFAS?
Well, of the target compounds that people are able to see with, using, commercial labs, you can really see the active ingredients in electrofluorination, 3M chemistry. That is PFOS. And so we have a great tools for being able to pick that up. And when you actually analyze an AFFF formulation, you're going to see gram per liter quantities of the sulfonates in there, and you're going to only see 1/100th of the carboxylates. So you can pick up ingredients in 3M AFFFs, primarily PFOS, and to a lesser extent, some of the carboxylates, and then there's some other things that labs aren't really set up to see right now. And when you think about fluorotelomers, basically our current methodologies at commercial labs will pick up small quantities of carboxylates and perhaps telomer sulfonates. But what's important to remember is when you look at the units on that, it's going to be like maybe a couple digit milligram per liter. Those are minor components, not the active ingredients. So the punchline is today's commercial labs aren't really set up to see the active ingredients in fluorotelomer AFFFs.
Great. Thanks, Jennifer. So I guess I'll ask a follow-up question on that. Are there other PFAS that we should be looking for in the environment that are not typically analyzed for but might be precursors to the commonly regulated PFAS like PFOA and PFOS?
Well, let's see. In terms of other PFAS you could pick up in the environment, I'm thinking of the C6 sulfonamide, which is the short chain cousin to FOSA or PFOSA, which is on our target lists that you can get through commercial labs. That is found in surface water. Some of the original work was done up in Canada by Scott Mayberry's group, and then our group has seen it in foam in surface water. So the C6 sulfonamide is mobile in the environment. It's water soluble and moving around. And then we've also seen it in groundwater, the works by Adamson and Nickerson. And then the other interesting one is a 5-3 fluorotelomer acid, and it seems to be associated with landfill leachates. It might even be a marker for landfill leachates, but we need more data to kind of support that. But none of those compounds have the chain length necessary to form or to result in the formation of PFOS or PFOA. So that's the good news. We haven't seen too many precursors with a chain length long enough to act as a precursor of PFAS or PFOA.
Thanks, Jennifer. I do have a question that I'd like to direct towards Richard. And as we're talking about the quote, air quotes again, Cliff, here, the modern foams, so modern fluoroelastomer foams. Richard, the question is, if the modern fluoroelastomer foams contain six carbon-based fluoroelastomers, and these could break down to perfluoroheptanoic acid, perfluorohexanoic acid, and perfluorobutanoic acid, each of which are regulated in various states, are states tracking the application of these new or modern fluoroelastomer foams?
So states are really just at the beginning of this, and only a few states are requiring notification when these modern foams are applied. We tried to address that in the tech reg in the AFFF chapter 3 in figure 3.1, where we outlined some best management practices. We are updating that for the next revision, and it goes from best management for purchasing AFFF to its use to disposal. And certain state emergency management groups and municipal and local fire departments are really trying to get a good handle on the best way to track and use the foams. But we really don't have a standardized process yet across the different users and industries on how to really track that.
Great. Thanks, Richard. And I want to ask one more foam question. Shalene, I'd like to direct this to you. Do we know how much PFAS are in foam or how much PFAS are in the AFFF? And for example, can you get a safety data sheet or an MSDS? Do those data sheets show PFAS percentages in AFFF products?
So currently the short answer is no. We don't generally see MSDSs with nice outlined composition of perfluoro compounds. Or PFAS in general. You can look at the keyword search, so look up perfluoro, fluoro, surfactant, to try and help you understand what's there, but they generally do not contain it. So in terms of what you do next, the total PFAS content in foams that are out on the market now really vary by manufacturer, by actual product within a manufacturer, as well as the specific PFAS compounds that are in that mixture. The current mil-spec does require that no more than 800 parts per billion of PFOA or PFOS be present in the mil-specified 24385 specified foam concentrate. So we do know that that is, in fact, the case for anything that's a mil-specified foam concentrate. We also know now, since last year, with the green screen that came out for AFFF, that they've identified that there is no intentionally added PFAS and no more than 100 parts per million of total organic fluorine as a present as a result of unintentionally added impurities. So that's another measure if you're using an AFFF that is certified through the green screen process. Generally, also the green screen certified firefighting foams require the entire PFAS chemical class. Do have a finding of less than one part per million of total organic fluorine of intentionally added product. There was one other quick question I just wanted to clarify on that came through that asked about 3% concentrate. That it's further diluted to create the final foam, so how much is it diluted? So generally, the slide that's up there right now is a 3% concentrate, and on that you see that more than 60% is water or diluent. That is in the 3% mixture, and less than 2% is fluorosurfactant. When that foam concentrate goes to the user, it then is diluted with 97% water. With that 3% concentrate that does contain 60% diluent or water. So hopefully that helps.
Thank you, Shalene. And thanks, folks, for keeping these questions coming in. We certainly appreciate that. I think we're going to switch over and have a couple questions about treatment for now. And I'm going to start with Cliff. What is the preferred method, both feasible and cost-effective, for home water treatment technologies, ion exchange resin, or granulated activated carbon, or reverse osmosis, maybe these technologies in series? Are there documents that describe the life cycle costs of in-home treatment compared to connecting to public supplied water?
Thanks, Kate. Really, all three of those technologies mentioned, so IX, GAC, and RO, are suitable and available for in-home treatment. Relatively inexpensive multi-stage filters are available with carbon and ion exchange, so both of those would likely eliminate any PFAS in the water if they're maintained properly. And ultimately, the choice of which technology to use can sometimes depend more on the water source than the actual PFAS concentrations, as there might be other constituents in the groundwater that could affect the efficiency of the treatment technology. So when you're thinking about details on the life cycle costs, these really aren't readily available because there are so many variables that can affect both the efficiency and the maintenance of the chosen technology. And as always, we recommend that a site-specific assessment would need to be made before you choose which technology to implement.
Okay, thanks, Cliff. So when we're talking about, we just talked about home water treatment technologies, but what treatment technologies have been implemented for public drinking water supplies? And are there standard specifications that have been developed for these approaches? And can you speak to the effectiveness and the associated cost?
Sure, you're really looking at the same list there. So the primary technologies related to PFAS in drinking water are GAC and IX, and RO is used, but that's a secondary treatment technology. Adsorption systems do have NSF and AWWA standards, though these are not specific for PFAS, and the equipment used to treat PFAS is pretty standard for drinking water applications. So in general, site-specific testing, such as rapid small-scale column tests for GAC, must be performed before designing any drinking water treatment system for PFAS. The operating expenses are, again, hard to predict and are driven by the background water quality, the PFAS concentrations, and, of course, what your treatment objectives are for the contaminated water.
Thank you, Cliff. So everything is site-specific, we hear. The next question I have is for Bill. Bill, is pump and treat primarily used as remedial action, or is it just used for containment and control?
Well, just like for any other soluble contaminant that we've dealt with historically, pump and treat is mostly effective when used for hydraulic containment or control, because matrix diffusion, which affects other soluble compounds, including the various soluble PFAS as well, ends up where pump and treat isn't really terribly effective for aquifer cleanup itself. So pretty much just for containment, hydraulic containment.
Okay, so Bill, if we're going to use pump and treat for containment, is there a particular depth that the extraction well should favor, either maybe target shallow zones or deeper zones for PFAS? And does that target depth vary based on the type of release? Like, would we want to target a different depth to address a release at a historic industrial site versus a release at a fire training area? Or does it change based on the types of PFAS present?
Well, that is an interesting question. And of course, it is site-specific, as you said. But most of the PFAS of concern that we're dealing with the most, the soluble PFOS, PFOA, that are fairly mobile, they don't really exhibit a DNAPL or LNAPL behavior. They're not floaters and sinkers. They behave as soluble compounds in water. Therefore, if you are investigating things or evaluating things, the first water that you hit is typically indicative of what your concentrations are going to be in an aquifer. However, you know, for an assessment for an RI, a nature and extent assessment, deeper samples may be required because you want to bound those impacts vertically. But as far as installing a system goes, you know, if the groundwater is diving at the site, then the soluble PFAS would also migrate downward in the aquifer, and a pump and treat containment would need to take that into account. Related to the circumstances of release, there's some evidence that can affect the occurrence in soil as to how much water has been flushing through, et cetera. But again, once it gets into the aquifer, it tends to behave as a soluble compound, and so that circumstance of release doesn't have that much impact on what you end up resulting in the aquifer in terms of what you see.
Great, good information. Thank you, Bill. But I'm not going to let you go. I want to direct this other question to you, too. because we're talking about containing source areas. So are capping and barrier walls being used for containing source material to reduce contact with groundwater or to reduce groundwater migration?
I'm not aware of any specific applications of that, but there's no reason why that wouldn't be a viable approach for hydraulic containment or you know, containing mobility or migration or mitigating migration of the plume. So, you know, of course, when barrier walls are implemented, typically you have to have extraction to prevent overfill from rainwater, et cetera. So, you know, maybe the combination of capping and that could be viable, but I'm not aware of any specific examples, and I don't think we have any reflected in our guidance document either. It certainly seems reasonable.
Okay. All right, thanks, Bill. Michelle, I'd like to direct the next question to you.
Sure.
Many of the treatment technologies that are being used to remediate groundwater seem to be by pump and treat using GAC or ion exchange, which is formerly the standard practice for other groundwater contaminants. However, other in-situ practices have since been implemented for other contaminants, and these other in-situ technologies are generally more efficient and cost-effective than pump and treat. So have in-situ treatments been developed and applied for treatment or destruction of PFAS in groundwater?
Well, one example, in-situ sequestration has been field demonstrated by a commercial vendor at about a half a dozen or so full-scale sites, and it appears to be effective. It's a sorption approach, not destruction. Destructive in-situ technologies, they've been tested on the bench scale, but to our knowledge, no successful full-scale in-situ field project has been conducted. But there's a demonstration that will be funded by ESTCP coming up this year that will be testing a new in-situ synolysis-based treatment approach.
Okay, so we'll have to stay tuned to learn a little bit more about this, this other approach and how effective it is. How about in soil? Bill, are there any in-situ technologies effective for soil treatment? And if there are any technologies, how effective are these methodologies?
Well, in-situ soil mixing can be done with various stabilizing or sequestering agents. There are a number of things on the market, and that has been demonstrated in the field to immobilize PFAS through sorption and prevent them from migrating any further down. In-situ thermal desorption has not been tested yet, but there's an ESTCP, USDOD-funded project, field demonstration project that should be conducted this year. But other than those two, I'm not aware of any other in-situ technologies demonstrated or documented or about to happen. I would say, you know, the guidance document does have references related to what we're aware of on the panel as well.
How about case studies, Bill or Michelle? Do you know of any case studies? Not sure, you know, the details in the guidance document or elsewhere.
Yeah, the case study information in the guidance document is mostly well documented, published examples. So there's a lot of good information in there on some of the more common practices, but some of the more obscure things that aren't very well documented, we don't really have case studies for that. So really, it depends on how well documented they all are. We do have some, yes.
Okay. All right. Thanks, Bill. Michelle, this next question I think I'm going to direct to you. How effective are the groundwater treatment technologies if the PFAS are a co-contaminant, like with a solvent plume?
Well, Kate, Emma, we are back to the it depends. It's a site-specific answer. Sorption with
okay.
can be effective for co-contaminants like chlorinated VOCs, BTECs, and other organic compounds. Your ion exchange resins for PFAS, they're specialized products for PFAS removal, but ion exchange in general can be an effective approach for some metals. RO, reverse osmosis, can be effective for co-contaminants in some cases, but clearly not in all cases. It's really up to the engineering design professionals to take those co-contaminants into account when selecting remedial technologies. Again, site-specific testing would be required to do the best design for situations where co-contaminants are present.
So, Michelle, how about this, though? This is a specific question that came in. Are there any known issues with co-contaminants when the preferred remedy is in situ colloidal carbon and polymer injection or barriers in the subsurface?
Yeah, co-contaminants can compete with PFAS in any sorptive treatment process, but the extent really is going to depend on the site-specific factors, like the concentrations of the contaminants and co-contaminants and their ratios, as well as the groundwater geochemistry.
Okay. So, Cliff, I have a follow-up question I think I'm going to send to you also about co-contaminants. One common co-contaminant at many of our sites is petroleum. And could you review how petroleum in particular could affect sorptive technologies or other in situ remedial techniques for PFAS?
Sure. Michelle touched on this a little bit, but petroleum-based co-contaminants will compete for those sorption sites, and that depends on the sorptive media processes that are part of that treatment. They could also interfere with kinetics and effectiveness of destructive treatment technologies that are being used. And again, it depends on many things, including PFAS and co-contaminant concentrations, what the site-specific properties are like, and what the characteristics are of the treatment approach. So again, we recommend that specific treatability testing be conducted before you try and implement one of these technologies.
Okay. Michelle, if you can come back on for this next question, please. Has there been any experimentation with pre-treated gas that would enhance short-chain PFAS absorption without significantly impacting loading capacity?
So there are some proprietary products out there that combine carbon with polymers or other types of materials for targeted treatment of short-chain compounds. And the guidance document does describe some of these products and also provides references for them. You know, there's lots of research coming down the pipeline on this topic as well. You know, I'm going to take a quick second to address, I see there's questions about rapid small-scale column tests, and this seems like a good place while we're talking about GAC to talk about those just for a quick moment. So the rapid small-scale Great. Column tests are becoming more and more standard as treatability tests for sorptive media that can help you understand site-specific competition and, you know, specific compound targeting, things like that. The question here is about how do those get validated, and really they need to be coupled with an on-site pilot test. So you can conduct the, you know, the small-scale column test, get your information, your sorption terms under your flow-through conditions, run a pilot test, and make sure those still apply as you upscale. So I'll just answer that shortly. Hopefully that helps.
Thank you, Michelle. And yes, please keep these questions coming. We really do appreciate all the questions that we are getting and try to work them in as we can through today's session. So another question about GAC for Cliff. Available information suggests that PFAS can break through GAC quicker than VOCs, and thus compliance schedules typically used for VOC treatment wouldn't be applicable. Are there established compliance sampling frequencies for GAC for PFAS treatment?
There really are no standard frequencies that have been developed for this. The sampling schedules are typically dictated by the various permits needed for this type of remediation. And presumably, the regulatory oversight entity will take into consideration the projected breakthrough for the PFAS when defining monitoring schedules and issuing permits. So these compliance schedules are likely determined on a case-by-case basis. And, of course, to go back to a big message with the water treatment piece, site-specific treatability testing is required to understand what those projected breakthrough times would look like, and those will obviously inform any of the permits that would be needed for this type of treatment.
Okay. All right. Thanks, Cliff. We have a number of questions on AFFF, so let's switch back over, invite Richard to come back on. And, Richard, I'm going to ask this question. How much fluorine-containing foam is being stored in tanks or otherwise at DOD sites and other locations?
So currently, much of the AFFF that's stored at DOD sites is stored in tanks, whether that be in hangars, tanks that supply firefighting suppression to airplane hangars, or stored in tanks in firefighting apparatus, or whether it's just stored in totes or drums or 5-gallon pails. So mostly stored in tanks. And also at FAA airports, most of them are required to still be mil-spec, and so they would have similar compositions. We know that DOD purchased most of the AFFF that was sold in the country, more than half for sure. And we know that the foams that are stored in these tanks would contain both legacy and modern AFFF foams. DOD is trying to transition away from their legacy C8 foams to more modern C6 foams. And they've done this at many locations, but not everywhere. And that's because obviously it takes time to do this, and also the DOD is hoping to get mil-spec fluorine-free foam that they could then start to change out those systems as well. One of the things that's nice to know, though, is that across almost all these sectors, that in training and testing activities, they've modified their processes so that they don't use fluorinated surfactants in that testing of their equipment or their firefighting capabilities. And so this minimizes the amount of fluorinated foam that it's being used or discharged to the environment.
Great. Thank you, Richard. The next question is also about PFAS and foam, and I'd like to ask Jennifer. Do we have any information and or data on PFAS concentrations and compositions for fluoroprotein-type foams, both currently and historically?
Well, there is a figure, figure 3.2 in the TechReg document that indicates essentially some general knowledge that fluorinated protein class B foams exist, and there's also some non-fluorinated class B protein foams. That actually came up a little bit earlier when Shailene was talking. In terms of the detailed concentration and composition, that is unknown. We here at Oregon State do have a few of those, and we are trying to crack the code and see what's in them, but right now we have very limited information.
Okay, so that's a wait and see, I guess. Hopefully we'll learn something from your work in the future. Shailene, the next question is for you. How frequently are AFFF, or I guess Class B foams, used? Is there still a lot of use today?
Class B foams are broadly used across several different industries, and those are all defined in the technical regulatory document. When you're talking specifically around AFFF, current AFFF use is really limited in the last year or two now to emergency response. Several states, starting with the state of Washington, did implore a ban on training for AFFF. Several states have since followed. So that is good news. So most of these states that have the ban are not using AFFF for any type of training exercises and only for emergency response. That said, mandatory AFFF use as required by military specification 24385, the DOD mil-spec, does require still, as Richard and I and Jennifer have said already, that both the DOD and certain airports under FAA are required to use mil-specified AFFF. So we do see still use there, not for training, but for emergency.
Great. Thank you, Shailene, for that information. This question is for Richard. Richard, can you please describe an actual fire training event? For example, how long do they typically last, and how often do they occur?
Sure. So for training purposes, you may or may not apply a fuel. Certainly in the past at FAA facilities and Department of Defense facilities, they would typically put fuel into a hole or a pit or a container and then light it on fire, and then you would fluff the AFFF onto the fire to encapsulate it and put it out. And this would happen relatively quickly. But one of the things is the Department of Defense does like to train, and they would train quite often. So these events could occur weekly or biweekly. I think that was more in the 60s, 70s, and 80s. And then more recently, that duration was less frequent. But the fire would be put out quickly. Where there was a lot of additional AFFF release to the environment was during equipment testing, where typically, in the case of the Air Force, they might dump the entire truck of AFFF to make sure that the equipment was working and then refill it, and also spills at firehouses on Department of Defense and FAA facilities.
Thanks, Richard. So since we're just talking about airports, FAA facilities, I have a question I'd like to send to Shalene. Shalene, have all of the airports in the U.S. done an initial investigation of AFFF inventory, releases, and presence on site? And are airports taking steps to limit future risk from AFFF releases?
Thank you. That's a good question. So airports do have a heightened awareness. However, by law, they're not currently required to sample. So currently, sampling activities in general are being driven at the state level, and only some states have dictated sampling at airports. A couple of those examples include Michigan, with an executive order that was put out for their PFAS statewide program, and then California, which has investigative orders by industry, and airports were under that last year. So many U.S. airports are trying to employ best management practices to limit future risk from AFFF releases. For example, best management practices have been published by the FAA, which governs Part 139 airports and response departments. That's an FAA CERT alert, they're called, and it's number 19-01. This states that mil-spec foam is required for AFFF testing, and to Richard's point earlier, under FAA, they are required to test their equipment on a regular basis per this Part 139 certification. So with this CERT alert, what they did was they required that AFFF testing may be conducted using one of three pre-approved closed-loop systems to minimize the environmental impact and release to the environment during that mandatory testing. They've also have development of SOPs for storage, handling, and disposal. The three pre-approved systems are Ecologic, NoFoam, and Oshkosh Eco-EFP. And in fact, some state departments have actually purchased some of these pre-approved equipments for circulation across airports, not just those one Part 139 airports, to support them during their required testing events. So that's a good positive direction.
Great. Thank you for that information, Shalene. Richard, let's get a little more local. Do you know if local fire departments track their AFFF use and purchase?
So it's certainly going to be different for different fire departments. Larger departments and smaller departments may be more sophisticated in what they track. So we don't really have anything in the tech reg that talks about that, except for the best management practices. Table 3.1 goes into that you should be tracking it, what you purchase and what you use. Experienced fire departments are really careful to track what they use because of possible cross-contamination. Many of them buy non-mil-spec AFFF, and some of them are not compatible with one another, and they can go through reactions if you mix them. And a lot of them have unfortunately learned that the hard way. Some of the smaller departments have been purchasing AFFF through mutual aid associations, and that makes record keeping more challenging. We hope to get the best management practices up to date with some of the comments we've received and get it back into the revised tech reg that's coming up. And it'll talk about the importance of tracking what you purchase and how you store it and how you use it, and also possible disposal options for AFFF.
Great. Thank you, Richard. Hopefully that information will be helpful for the users of the document. And I have another actual follow-up question that I want to ask for you about the use of AFFF at training facilities by the local or a volunteer fire department. Was it, or I guess, or is it very common for a local fire department to use AFFF, or is it just limited to special training?
So certainly for volunteer fire departments or local paid fire departments, the training with AFFF is limited in frequency and duration, but it certainly varies from location to location. Many of the municipal fire departments have centralized training facilities That's where we would often look for AFFF releases. And there was some training that occurred at municipal locations, but that would be on a case-by-case incident.
Okay. Thanks, Richard. Another question about AFFF I'd like to send to Jennifer. Do AFFF releases cause air deposition of PFAS? And if so, how significant are those impacts relative to air deposition impacts from an industrial facility?
Well, I wish I had a really good answer for that question, but unfortunately, I don't. What I can say is there's at least two pieces of literature out there. Some work done by Swiss, Favreau et al., who demonstrated first demonstration of volatile PFAS in AFFF. And this is the fluorotelomer alcohol class, but as an example, you can see like 180 milligram per liter in a fluorotelomer formulation of the telomer alcohol, the volatile one. But if you look at active ingredients, they're up in the thousands of milligram per liter. So they are unreacted intermediates, and there's also a new piece by Roth et al. That also demonstrated that you can see volatile PFAS in AFFF or aerosols breaking above an AFFF. So we have just a really limited amount of information that says they're there. And so then to answer this question, is there air deposition? I think that's just way ahead of where we are right now in terms of trying to understand that possibility. And it also means we really can't put that into context relative to the better studied industrial downwind type deposition cases. There's much more information on that.
All right. Thanks for that information, Jennifer. Richard, we'll move back to you. What is being done to investigate spills of AFFF that weren't previously required to be reported as a spill?
Kate Emma. Some states have passed legislation to require reporting of AFFF use or spills. Some examples are New York State and Washington State, and also your state of New Hampshire has put out advisories to fire departments that they must report the use of AFFF. I will add that in an indirect way, many states are requiring sampling of public water systems or sampling of water systems around fire departments, and that's kind of a backdoor way to also check for uses of AFFF at those facilities. Our team is working on expanding the regulatory table to include all of the activities that are going on in the various states. And we hope to have that published by the end of the year.
Great. Thanks, Richard. And just put in another plug for that table. It will hopefully cover programs that are not just AFFF, but all different types of PFAS regulatory programs that might be occurring in any particular state in the U.S. So hopefully that'll be another great resource for all of our readers. We have a number of questions now on treatment. I'm going to switch back over to Michelle. Michelle, for each of the technologies we're talking about, can you please describe how each technology actually destroys or transfers the PFAS?
Sure. Well, to some extent I can. So many technologies, as you mentioned, don't actually destroy PFAS, but they merely transfer them to another medium, such as from the aqueous phase to a solid phase, like carbon sorption or ion exchange. PFAS destruction approaches typically involve really high heat and or pressure and generation of really aggressive free radicals, especially aqueous electrons. So I don't really have time to address each technology one at a time on our our meeting here today, but there's lots of references that are provided in the guidance document that point to detailed mechanisms. They also can be found in recently published review papers that focus on treatment mechanisms. There's a lot of new up-to-date review papers out there now.
Great, thank you. And I'm hoping that we're going to incorporate some of those papers, or at least the references for those in our upcoming revisions to the TechReg. Cliff, this is a question I feel like we get a lot. What approaches are used to manage remedial waste? And are there any publications that describe requirements or recommendations for waste determination and disposal?
Thanks, Kate Emma. Yeah, management of remedial waste is definitely something that needs to be considered when you're evaluating the different PFAS treatment technologies. The US EPA did recently publish a document in December 2020 titled Interim Guidance on Destroying and Disposing of Certain PFAS and PFAS-Containing Materials That Are Not Consumer Products. So kind of a mouthful, and I will note that the document was released for public comment, and the public comment period did end in February, so there might be revisions coming to this document to remove that interim title. The document does outline proven technologies for addressing PFAS waste, including thermal treatment, landfilling, and underground injection. It also addresses gaps in the current knowledge for PFAS destruction and disposal, and identifies that there are needs for ongoing research around these topics. As for regulations governing waste determination and disposal, these are currently poorly developed, as PFAS are not designated as hazardous substances under any current federal environmental regulatory programs. Some states have regulated these compounds and have published guidance outlining their rules. Of course, we recommend contacting your local regulators when deciding how to manage and dispose of PFAS remedial waste. And this doesn't quite fit here, but there was a question that came in on the regeneration carbon. This is a viable option, and GAC can be thermally reactivated. There is also some research out there that shows that you can regenerate GAC with solvents, so that's something to consider as well. And if the use of reactivated GAC is being considered, again, we recommend that you contact your regulatory agency, as there might be some limitations on how that regenerated GAC might be approved for use. So it would depend on the application. If it is a drinking water application, there might be some additional restrictions around that.
Well, good. Thanks for that follow-up, Cliff. I actually want to ask you another question. You know, we just talked about thermal treatment, and it's identified in the EPA document. We know that incineration has been an emerging issue. I know I'm seeing a number of questions come in today about incineration. Can you speak about whether incineration is used for treatment of PFAS-impacted media? And if so, is there a resource that has published minimum combustion temperatures to reach complete destruction of PFAS?
Sure. Yeah, incineration is still being utilized as a treatment option, but it does remain a hot topic for PFAS destruction. And in addition to that interim guidance document I mentioned, I would also point folks to a technical brief that was published by the EPA in July of 2019. And this specifically discusses the use of incineration to manage PFAS waste streams. And it's only a couple pages long, so pretty easy read, and it provides a good summary on the state of the science around incineration. And both of these documents do provide information on the combustion temperatures that have been identified in research settings to destroy PFAS. Though both documents also identify gaps in the research and acknowledge that the ability to completely destroy PFAS through incineration is not well understood. So this is an active area of research, and we expect that the science behind incineration for PFAS-impacted waste will advance in the coming years.
All right. Thanks, Cliff. You have another thing that we'll be paying attention to as time goes on. And I want to invite Bill to come back on as we're talking about waste products. So, Bill, can you speak to how spent resins might be managed?
Sure. So some specialty ion exchange resins can be regenerated on site, and there are systems now being built and installed around the world to do that regeneration when the resins are spent. But most single-use ion exchange resins are generally either landfilled or incinerated. In some cases, they're actually even burned in lower temperature thermal desorption kilns like cement kilns because they're commonly a polystyrene-based material that does have some BTU value and can be burned up. One thing for sure, like Cliff said, it's critical to work with your regulators to be sure that all of these things are acceptable in the state's regulatory program. And as we all know, regulations are changing, and if things are determined at a state or federal level to be designated as hazardous, then those disposal options could change in the future.
Thanks, Bill. And actually, just got this question in to clarify a little bit about incineration. Can you clarify the status of using incineration to destroy PFAS, given that only a small number of PFAS analytes can be detected through air testing?
Yeah, and as I mentioned earlier and some of what Cliff said, you know, the EPA is working on sampling and analytical methods for testing off gases from thermal systems. So that's an area of active research right now to try to come up with standardized approaches. For now, the well-documented proof of destruction in incinerators is limited. There's some good published information on very limited compounds as well. But I would also note that in some cases, like there's a kiln in Alaska treating soil, PFAS-laden soil thermally, and they're permitted based on a limited analytical monitoring, but also on total fluorine. So there are other ways to kind of understand, you know, what the potential emissions might be related to PFAS desorption. That's desorption with some off-gas treatment for destruction, but, you know, again, the incinerator data is pretty lacking in the industry right now.
Okay, certainly we'll be looking for more about in the coming future. Shalene, question for you, is there an approved disposal method for virgin or spent AFFF?
So as Cliff mentioned earlier, the EPA document on disposal that was released late last year did identify or give a state of the practice for all different types of things and did include spent AFFF or AFFF in that document. But currently there is not an approved disposal method for AFFF that's broadly accepted at the federal and state regulatory authority level. Disposal of AFFF products does represent a significant challenge, really, for any owner of firefighting foam concentrates. The disposal of concentrate through all currently available disposal options does carry an inherent risk and potential future liability that the operator user should be aware of, such that best disposal options can be selected and potential liability can be considered, really. The ITRC PFAS team, Richard mentioned, is currently working on an AFFF disposal table that will be released later this year. In it, we are presenting the currently available options, including stabilization and burial, deep well injection and incineration, those that have been identified in the EPA document, as well as advantages and disadvantages associated with each of those methods. And then we go beyond that and list the experimental disposal technologies under development. The disposal options currently available for materials impacted with dilute AFFF waste are presented in Section 12 of our technical regulatory document. So you can look there if you want more information.
Thanks, Shalene. I have a follow-up question for you. In the AFFF section, there's a discussion of disposal of flush water that might have dilute concentrations of PFAS. Is there any number yet or some sort of indication of a waste threshold for disposal of liquids or solids? The participant says that any activity we have seems to generate significant amounts of rinse water and every increasing amount of decontamination water. Excuse me.
Yeah, that is a really great question and a challenging one. There really currently is no widely accepted criteria or number for waste thresholds for disposal of liquids or solids. In various case studies, we know people are doing it globally. So there are case studies out there. Values have generally followed published values, whether it's guidance or promulgated rule for the different media. An example of 70 parts per trillion for groundwater and drinking water in some cases. We've seen it lower in state values. We are trying to put together a table that will be published before the end of the year regarding case studies, specifically for cleanup and disposal, and hope we can touch on that and at least document it where noted as to what the criteria were for those individual case studies.
Great. Thanks, Shalene. And I just want to add, you just mentioned different state and federal regulatory values that might be out there. We do have our regulatory guidance values table that we do try to update just for soil and groundwater or drinking water. And there are a number of questions that are coming in about regulations, and I think address some of those questions about those values. So those are the types of topics that we're going to be discussing at our next roundtable. So if you do have the questions, please keep those coming in today, but we're not going to be focusing on those responses the rest of our discussion. I do have one more question about that I'd like to send to Cliff right now. It's kind of about incineration. So Cliff, while incineration is being studied, can you identify whether there are other technologies that will destroy PFAS and not just absorb them?
Yes, there are, but unfortunately most of these are still being studied at smaller scales and have not been tested in the field yet. A few examples of these destruction technologies include electrochemical treatment, non-thermal plasma, and cyanolytic treatment for liquids. These are all covered in the TechReg document as well as many others that describe current destructive technologies, so I would direct folks to look to the guidance document for more detail around those.
All right, thanks, Cliff. Bill, question for you. Can PFAS degrade in the natural environment? Have degradation rates been measured in laboratory settings?
One of the key things is PFAS is obviously a broad suite of a gazillion compounds. So there are some that can degrade in natural environments. Mostly those are precursors through some enzymatic and sort of oxidation processes that are biologically mediated. There's not a ton of documented evidence of complete destruction, and especially the target compounds we're most concerned with, like PFOS right now, it's a very tough compound to destroy, and so there's pretty limited evidence of biological breakdown. But I would point my own opinion here. 20 years ago, we thought MTBE and 1,4-dioxane were non-biodegradable, but increasingly we've understood now that biodegradation does occur and is probably, in fact, common. So, hope springs eternal that we'll find some biological solution for this.
So Bill, then, I'm going to say, is bioremediation of PFAS a tested technology? Do we know if there's any microbes that can help with cleanup? Have we learned anything about that yet?
Well, there doesn't seem to be any direct destruction by the microbes because they don't really get enough energy out of it for the energy it takes to break those bonds. There are some fungal enzymes that have been shown to break some precursors down, but then it breaks them down to produce the carboxylic acids that are kind of the daughter product, end products. But again, all of this is really just in the beaker scale at this point, and there may be some oxidative enzymatic reactions that are robust enough, and we can figure out how to feed them and make that happen. But for right now, I certainly wouldn't call it a tested technology.
Okay. Now, Bill, what about phyto? Can phyto remediation be effective for PFAS treatment?
Well, that's another interesting one because there's a lot of research right now from a human health risk assessment or even agricultural assessment looking at uptake of PFAS into plants and whether that could be a problem related to risk assessment. And there is some evidence that some plants do pull PFAS from the soil and shallow groundwater into the plant material and in some cases in the fruiting bodies that folks might eat, I guess. So that being said, there's evidence of plant uptake, but nobody's really done anything that I know of related to applying it as a phytoremediation, remedial action. So again, that may be mm-hmm. something that we include in the future as valuable, but for right now, there's limited evidence of that.
Okay, thank you for that, Bill. Michelle, another question for you. Is exposure to UV effective for treatment? And if so, how much?
Well, there's actually little evidence of the effectiveness of UV alone in destroying PFAS, especially the PFSAs. Some destruction of PFCAs, the carboxylics, have been documented in bench scale testing, though. More often you see UV coupled with an oxidant for activating that oxidant. And those can be effective, again, with some of the carboxylic acids, but less so with the sulfonic acids. And this might be a good point to address one of the questions, was does boiling water work to break the carbon-fluorine bond? And, the answer to that is no. Hopefully you're getting the message here that it really requires very aggressive approaches to break down PFAS.
All right. Thanks, Michelle. So earlier we heard Jennifer and Shalene, Richard talk about AFFF manufacturers, formulations, et cetera. So the question I have now is for Jennifer. For AFFF release sites, Is it possible to tie a release of AFFF and the associated AFFF impacts found in soil and groundwater to a particular AFFF manufacturer, formulation, and time frame of manufacture?
Well, that's yet another great question. The good news is there's a number of groups around the country that have been funded to tackle this information or try to get this information. So it's very, I'd say it's premature, but I think we're going to get there. What makes that a little challenging is, I think as people recognize, you know, PFAS, seeing that in the field indicates, you know, pretty clear use of an AFFF containing ECF-based chemistry. And at present, we largely associate that with 3M AFFF. And so that's pretty straightforward. But the telomer sulfonates, we're picking these up as contaminants in the field, but they can arise potentially from a number of precursors from a number of fluorotelomer-based AFFF. So it's going to be a lot more trickier there to kind of sort out, especially among the fluorotelomer manufacturers. And that's... you know, in part because of telomer sulfonates. They occur as those minor impurities, but they're also a major intermediate. And I know there's a question here coming up and questions in the chat about, you know, are there transformation pathways? But that telomer sulfonate is definitely one. But the problem is we can't trace that back one for one to a particular manufacturer, formulation, or particular time frame. One thing we can do, though, is say that when we look in a kind of an academic setting, for fluorotelomer precursors, which were some of those complicated molecules you saw a little bit earlier in the slides, you can actually inspect those molecules and see that sulfur going up. Those are the precursors to telomer sulfonates. But they can also get, and so there you see in the slides right now, those red circled S's are all potential sulfurs that might get oxidized to this telomer sulfonate. So you can see that, and this was a snapshot from mil-spec back in the day, a while ago, pre-requalification. They all potentially can form those telomer sulfonates. So it's going to get tricky, and we just don't really see much evidence of those intact precursors, which is signaling that these fluorotelomer precursors are biodegradable. The other thing you want to keep an eye out for, if you're interested in this type of question, which is really a forensics question, is keep an eye out and ask for information on your carboxylic acids, because these molecules that you see in this sheet, especially the one in the upper right, I think I got that right, National Foam, nope, bottom lower left, that one has actually been well studied, and that one shows telomer sulfonate formation, but also carboxylates, and it's only going to produce linear carboxylates. So when you start taking a really close look at, say, your sulfonates and carboxylates, and you're trying to understand manufacturer formulation and time frame, keep an eye on those linear carboxylates, because remember, they, as far as we know today, we never had an ECF-based AFFF that was mostly carboxylates. That is folklore. So they're minor minor components in the real AFFF, but when you see them at or above, which we have seen, carboxylates at or above sulfonates, check out. They might be linear, and they might be giving you a clue that you had telomer precursor biotransformation at your site.
Thank you, Jennifer. That's definitely some great information there. And I guess I'd ask Shalene, do you have anything that you'd like to add to what Jennifer just responded to about manufacturer formulation and time frame of manufacture?
Jennifer did a great job, as always. I think there it is a really active area of research, and there are several challenges around it. So just looking at the patterns of use and procurement alone, AFFF, you know, were stockpiled often, so they were not necessarily used in the same year that they were purchased. They could have been used many, many years past when they were purchased. Also, just the fact that being listed on the QPL, the DoD qualified product list, did not necessarily indicate it was a large-scale purchase by an individual base or an individual location. And you do see variation by year for a given manufacturer, and that's not yet documented. So I had said earlier that not all foams are created equal, and that is the case for AFFF or fluorine-free. That makes everything a little bit more difficult when you're thinking about forensics. We do have an update to the technical regulatory document that will be coming out before the end of the year, We're going to add a section in our AFFF chapter on environmental forensics, and so hopefully that'll shed some light for readers.
Great. Okay, thanks, Jalene.
Jennifer, can I throw one more thing on there? As Jalene was talking, I also saw some questions roll by, and one question quite some time ago was, you know, did AFFF manufacturers pay for information on their formulations? Are they funding it? And I'll say from our perspective, the answer is no. I just want to say that the information that we know about AFFF composition that we've published and Baki and is cited in the ITRC document, that is taxpayer funding. CERTIP and ESTCP are federal programs, and those are the dollars that have helped us reverse engineer some of these materials. And now there's been analyses since the time, and now you can get those analyses in contract labs. But some of that original reverse engineering was done on a taxpayer's dime. And then there was another question about composition. And basically, unless you undertake an effort to understand what the composition is, that I think to date is still confidential business information. And that's why it's not easily seen on, say, like an MSDS.
Sure. Okay. So, Jennifer, I'm going to have you stay on, and let's talk a little bit more about breakdown. So is there an expected or typical degradation pathway observed at AFFF release sites for polyfluorinated precursors to transform to perfluoroalkyl acids like PFOA and PFOS?
Well, we touched on that briefly, but if you look at the slide right now, that lower, the chemical in the lower left by Ansel, et cetera, that's the one that has been studied. That's the one that's been documented both in the laboratory by two different groups, Canada, U.S., that generates the fluorotelomer sulfonates and shorter chain carboxylates. And so that is one pathway we're definitely aware of. Now, interestingly enough, there's also additional work on the telomer sulfonates, very well done. They further biodegrade under aerobic conditions, but to date, there's no evidence that they degrade anaerobically, which is why I think we see them in oxic groundwater conditions. We don't have the right microbial consortia, and we don't have, you know, oxygen conditions. So telomer sulfonates seem to build up in groundwater, and then that might change as they exit into surface water. And there was another question about transformation a little bit earlier on. So we've talked today about telomer transformation. It turns out the chemistry of the 3M chemistry is a little, those are harder nuts to crack. There's definitely been some efforts to look at the biotransformation. The limited evidence suggests that the C6 acid, PFHXA, and the sulfonate, PFHXS, that's the C6 sulfonate, and the C6 amide, when you see elevated levels of that compared to what we know to be in AFFF formulations, these just might be indicators of transformation of some of the 3M chemistry in the field. But I want to say it's somewhat limited because we see more of the precursors hanging around in field sites of the 3M chemistry.
Okay. So, Jennifer, we're going to get a little more specific on some of these questions. And I'm going to read two questions for you. Do the longer chain PFAS and AFFF typically break down to shorter chain PFAS once they're in the environment? And then the follow to that is, what mixtures of PFAS would we typically see at an AFFF site where there's been some degree of weathering that's occurred? So when you're comparing what you're seeing at a site to the original composition in the AFFF.
Well, let's see. We touched on a few of those. So if you're looking at the slide and you look at that Ansel, now again, that's a telomer product. That means we've got that fluorinated tail and those brackets right there, and then we've got two carbons that aren't fluorinated. That molecule, you can see biotransformation shorten that chain. You can see C4 and 5 and 6 carboxylates and some unsaturated intermediates. So that's an example where a longer chain there is evidence that it can break down a bit, not completely, but that's a fluorotelomer. And as I mentioned with regard to the 3M chemistry, it's a little harder to see direct evidence of transformation in the field, but some of those C6 compounds, because the precursors, the other funny things in there really aren't long chain. They're really short chain. They're like 6 C6 or less. So if those are being partially transformed, that's why you could potentially see elevated levels of the C6 carboxylates and sulfonate and amide in that area.
Okay. Thank you, Jennifer. I'm going to switch over to Richard. So given what we're just hearing from Jennifer and Shalene, how safe is it to assume that groundwater containing fluorotelomers and related precursor compounds are, quote, more recent releases in that the fluorotelomer-based foams were the predominant form of HPLF since the 2000s?
Well, that's probably not a very safe assumption at all. And the reason for that is because legacy fluorotelomer foams have been around since the 1970s. They may not have been the predominant foams, but they have been around. As was mentioned, environmental forensics is a tricky process for PFAS and AFFF. Jennifer and Shalene touched on some of those. I think we need to use multiple lines of evidence when we try and figure out sources and differentiate between different AFFFs. But the one thing that you probably can say is that the phase out of the longer chain PFAS by manufacturers has shown an increase more recently to shorter chain concentrates and a decrease of the longer chains. So this could indicate a more recent release, but again, I think you need multiple lines of evidence to say that with any certainty.
All right, thanks, Richard. And it is definitely an area that we're trying to work to update the guidance document over the next year and just detailing what some of those multiple lines of evidence would be needed for some forensic work. So, Jennifer, if you can come back on, we have another question about some of the precursors. So, in this particular case, it's precursors N-ethyl and N-methyl sulfonamidoacetic acid. And so for those of you following along with the acronyms, it's N-E-T-F-O-S-A-A, and similarly, N-M-E-F-O-S-A-A. So if we have those compounds in soil and groundwater, what does the presence of that indicate about the potential source material? Does it indicate that AFFF is the source? Does it indicate that the PFAS are from a fluorotelomer source? What does that tell us?
Well, those molecules are only derived from electrofluorination chemistry, which means when you see them in the environment at sufficient concentrations, they appear branched and linear. So they're very much in line. So if you look at the slide, you know, we see that electrofluorination chemistry, one of the hallmarks is branched and linear isomers. And that's true for these compounds. So those compounds are signaling electrofluorination as a chemical process. It's unclear to me whether it's an unequivocal indicator of AFFF. For example, some of Chris Higgins' early work to identify these was actually done in municipal wastewater. Now, that doesn't mean AFFF don't contribute to the wastewater, but they're just there in wastewater treatment, mostly biosolids. And so there may be more than one source. So I'm not yet convinced those are, you know, a signal of AFFF themselves. What I can say is they're definitely not signaling a fluorotelomer source. That's not a chemically plausible pathway.
Okay, great. Thanks for that clarification. So sticking with some identification of sources, Richard, if one needs to evaluate if the impacts are from different AFFF releases or sources, what's the approach that should be used? For example, should ratios of certain PFAS be compared, or should the evaluation include a determination of the presence or absence of certain PFAS?
Sure. Yeah, ratios are a great place to start, as well as tracking some of the ratios of branched to linear isomers, recognizing that partitioning and transport can alter some of those ratios. I know at some of the sites I've had where we have impacted water supplies, one of the first things I've looked at is the ratio of what's in the water supply compared to the ratio of what's in the suspected source area. Some of the other things you might want to pick up on is PFAS such as fluorotelomer acids, which might be associated with landfills, or ether compounds as more and more of that becomes available with more sophisticated analytical chemistry.
Okay. Thanks, Richard. So one more question about this topic. Jennifer, can you please discuss how we can forensically identify AFFF impacts from other PFAS sources?
Well, I always get the great questions. I wish I had great answers. I'm right
Sorry
now
about
forensically.
That.
Well, somebody's got to take them. So right now I think people recognize the challenges of trying to do forensics with our current suite of measurable PFAS. Think target compounds that you can get say, from commercial labs. And they're doing a fantastic job, by the way, and lists are evolving and increasing, which I think is the direction we need to go. But with those targets in mind, groups have used statistical approaches to try to ferret out forensic-type information and relationships. But it's challenging because those materials, things, carboxylates, sulfonates, they're found in so many things, meaning articles in commerce that end up in wastewater. They're in landfill leachate. They're in AFFF. And so it's really tough to work with a very limited number of compounds. So if we move our view to a little bit broader and consider, especially for AFFF, those precursors got kind of fancy. So we have the anionic ones we're kind of familiar with, but there were also a large number, especially when it came to electrofluorination, and some telomers, zwitterionic species. This means molecules that possess both negative and positive charges. And what we're trying to do right now is figure out the diversity of those molecules and to what materials do they belong. Is it mil-spec? Is it not mil-spec? Or is it some wicked combination of the two? And then what about those other source terms like, electroplating, for example? So really trying to understand those source terms in all their complexity, and then looking, what we want to do with a CERTIP-funded forensics project is look at the complexity and then try to distill out the essence. Which ones are really markers? Which ones are, if any, can be attributed to a particular source? So forensics is right at that state of the art where we want to use not only chemical information, but we want to place that into essentially multiple lines of evidence. So there's site characterization and history and hydrology, and all of this is going to come together to help us understand or explain, you know, sources of PFAS. So forensics has been done for other contaminant classes like chlorinated solvents, PIHs, and it's a well-developed discipline. It's just now coming to PFAS. And so as we get going here, people should, if available, pay attention to the isomer profiles, branched and linear. Take a look at those and monitor those chain length ratios. Keep in mind, though, that transport can alter the chain length ratios because transport's going to retard the longer chains over the branch. But you want to keep that in mind. And then we're trying to find these unique source-specific markers that might give us a clue about a source term. There was a question in the box about landfill marker. So again, we kind of have a working hypothesis that a 5-3 fluorotelomer carboxylic acid, which might be coming to a method near you, don't ask me which one, but I do know labs are working to pick up this molecule, just might be an indicator for landfill leachates. And then lastly, one of the big tools here that's going to help us is this high-resolution mass spectrometer. Our goal is to identify some important points on source terms, and we are getting fantastic help. I have to shout out here to Richard on the line from states who are interested in this question, providing samples from different source terms, trying to help put that together with high-resolution mass spec to tease out, are there markers that will help us with PFAS forensics. And the ITR team page is adding, well, the team is adding a forensics section to the TechReg document, and it should be available later this year.
Great. Thanks, Jennifer. Let's see. We're coming up. We have a little bit more time left today. I want to get through a few more AFFF questions and try to wrap up with some treatment questions. Again, if we don't get through all the questions today, we are going to be preparing a digest, and we'll try to give you at least a written response to those other questions. So if you have anything else, just please put it in that Q&A pod so that we can address it later on. So Richard, a question here is, what is the typical timeline from release of AFFF to contamination of soil and groundwater?
Sure. So the timeline when AFFF releases or application can contaminate soil and groundwater can depend on a lot of site-specific factors like total organic carbon or depth to the water table. But remember that during firefighting operations or system testing or any release, it'll impact soil almost immediately and can also impact groundwater very quickly. And the reason for that is, in addition to applying the foam, departments are also adding a large amount of water to suppress the fire. And because the AFFF is highly miscible, the impact can be very quick. So in the document, what we really talk about for initial mitigation efforts is to reduce the footprint of the contamination by limiting the spread of the foam and the fire water. And you can do this through various containment measures, pre-planning, and recovery tactics to make sure that the release has been abated and response personnel are safe. And we have more detailed information in section 3.5 of the tech reg on that particular problem.
Great. Thanks, Richard. So, Shalene, a question for you. Where should site characterization efforts be focused to address AFFF releases? And I'm going to ask, are there areas to consider beyond like a crash or a training site that we might not typically expect?
That's a good question. So site characterizations should really focus on the fire training areas as well as the equipment testing areas primarily. Some things that we've identified in our technical regulatory document to look at the low volume releases of foam concentrate. So that happens during storage, transfer, any type of operational requirements, or just periodic equipment calibration. Then look at moderate volume discharge of foam solution. So once that foam concentrate is mixed into solution with water, you're going to look at the apparatus testing, episodic discharge of AFFF containing fire suppression systems as an example in hangars and buildings. And then lastly, occasional high volume broadcast discharge of foam. And that generally happens in firefighting and emergency response. In response to your question around crash or training sites, and should you look elsewhere, there definitely are secondary sources that should be considered, knowing that PFAS are persistent. You are going to find it wherever it was discharged. So some good questions to ask are, has construction taken place? Any soils that have been disturbed or moved or relocated? Are there stormwater systems at or near these vicinities? That can often direct AFFF when it was discharged from a primary area to secondary sources. One anecdotal example is in Vermont, where there was a site where soils had AFFF in them. They were buried during an airport expansion. And there's two locations where the PFAS soils are under many tens of feet of soil. So understanding where and how the site has been developed is very important.
Certainly. Great. Thanks very much, Shalene. And Shalene, I'd like to ask you one more question, because we did get a number of questions about this today. If someone is doing a foam transition, changing from a legacy foam to a modern foam or maybe a fluorine-free foam, how much cleaning is required? Is there particular research on how to clean piping and tanks that have contained AFFF, such that the new replacement foam is not contaminated with the PFAS? And one of the participants gave an example and said that their aviation facilities have AFFF fire protection systems, and the AFFF has migrated through the piping backflow preventers into the broader water distribution network. They have triple rinsed the piping, they've sampled for PFOA and PFOS several times, and they can't obtain levels less than the standard, in this case, which is 70 parts per trillion. So they're looking for more information on technologies to clean the piping and the valves, and they're considering piping replacement. And they actually mentioned that they have the same situation with fire truck storage tanks as well. So, Shalene, if you're able to come off, stay off of mute on that one. So,
sorry,
really, you know, how much cleaning is required? Sure, I can hear you now.
Okay, so that's a very challenging question and one that faces many industries. So, currently, unfortunately, there is very little published about how cleaning should be done, what's considered acceptable during foam transition, and the best mix of how to do this. Triple rinse with water has been mentioned. That has been used in some cases. Solvent-based solutions is another example of what's been used. There is, however, research currently being conducted by ESTCP and CERTIP to evaluate appropriate methodologies for cleanup. There's other examples outside of them as well. For both the piping, the tanks, and everything during transition from a fluorinated foam to fluorine-free. Some examples include perfluoride, D desalination, nanofiltration, plasma technology, those are just a few. Some of them are showing promise, but really there's many factors that come into play when you're considering decontamination of a system. One other promising thing that's going on is the National Fire Protection Association, NFPA. Their research foundation, I'm lucky enough to be a part of a project that just kicked off to develop best management practices and guidance for transition from AFFF to fluorine-free foams. And they have participants on the panel and the technical board for this project that range from airports to oil and gas to Department of Defense. So there's a lot of participants on it to make sure that it's we get the best of every world and every industry that's facing it. And we can provide the link in the document that we're going to provide afterwards, the digest.
In the digest, excellent. That would be great. Thank you. So just let's wrap up with a couple questions about treatment. Michelle, can you let us know, is treatment typically focused only on long-chain PFAAs, the perfluoroalkyl acids, or are short-chain PFAAs included in treatment goals, even if these aren't regulated yet?
Well, in the lab where researchers are developing and advancing treatment approaches, we are indeed looking at the shorter chain compounds and a broad suite of PFAS more generally. But I'd like to throw that question over to Bill to see what his perspective is based on what he's seeing at the field scale.
Sure. I would say that in general, since the field systems that are operating now have a focus or an objective of compliance with regulations, and those regulations seldom focus on the short-chain PFAS. So, that may change in the future as additional compounds are regulated, and everybody will need to look at more than just a few of those. But for now, I think they're only focused on the couple that are regulated. And then, you know, of course, there are some facility owners who are interested in treating all detectable PFAS, and then that's limited by the analytical suites in that case. So the answer is sort of yes and no.
Great. Thanks, Michelle, and thanks, Bill. So, Michelle, can you tell us about the effects that precursors have on treatment effectiveness and vice versa, the effects that treatment might have on precursors?
Sure. So while treatment decisions at present may tend to focus on PFOS and PFOA as the commonly regulated PFAS, it's also important to understand what's going on with the precursors before, during, and after treatment. Precursors can compete with sorption sites, for example, and they'll also impact the efficiency of destructive treatment processes. So our target PFOS and PFOA compounds can, in fact, form as intermediates during destructive treatment. So understanding these transformations is really important. So the impacts can go both ways.
So Michelle, how would you track that or measure that that effectiveness?
It's kind of a tricky endeavor. We only have analytical standards for a small handful of the hundreds of precursors that can be present. But by measuring total fluorine, fluoride, and by conducting the TOP assay, we can understand at least semi-quantitatively the initial precursor load and effects of treatment on precursors. We can also then have some site-specific understanding of treatment effectiveness and efficiency. So, you know, multiple lines of evidence.
Great. Thanks, Michelle. Cliff, I have a question I'd like to send to you. Are there demonstrated effective technologies to remove PFAS from wastewater and biosolids apart from thermal destruction? And does the remedial technology matter based on the source, like an AFFF release or an industrial release?
There are many researchers working on this, but we're unaware of treatment approaches that are currently commercially available for treating PFAS in wastewater and biosolids. The efficiency of the viable approaches will likely depend on the PFAS source, so that if it's an AFFF source or other industrial sources, but the ultimate effectiveness of the treatment technology probably does not depend on the source itself.
Okay, thanks. And Cliff, I actually want to ask one more question for you that came in as a follow-up to the discussion we had earlier Some water systems are reporting that GAC is less effective with the new very low target PFAS safe drinking water standards, such that older treatment systems are needing to be upgraded to technologies such as resin. And is there anything we can speak about for this first generation or second generation treatment evolution?
Yeah, to our knowledge, there really is no evidence that shows that GAC is less effective for chasing those lower target levels. It's generally a matter of economics around using GAC to achieve those lower target levels and not the technical effectiveness. So, of course, we recommend that site-specific evaluations be performed when considering these lower standards and how to upgrade an existing treatment system to achieve them, but generally it might not require a wholesale change in the technology.
Great. Thanks, Cliff. Bill, I'd like you to come back on. I have a few questions here. So given the high cost of PFAS removal and off-site disposal, is soil stabilization effective for PFAS?
Yeah, soil stabilization with a number of sort of tailored amendments has been shown to be effective pretty much at full scale at this point. And it can be implemented either ex situ or in situ in terms of either using an excavator and mixing it all up above ground or in situ with large diameter augers or other methods of doing it in place. But and a wide variety of sorbents have been tried in different levels of development. But overall, I think the concept is a good one in terms of eliminating or, you know, mitigating that PFAS leaching from the soils.
Okay, so Bill, can soil characteristics and partitioning impact the effectiveness of soil stabilization?
Yeah, absolutely. One of the things is depending on the mechanism for that stabilization, the soil chemistry and makeup has a big difference. For instance, if you know we're using sorption with carbon or clays, the soil types can have a big impact, mostly through competitive adsorption. And in some cases, there are some factors of the soil that could actually help, and carbon sorption could be occurring in the soil already, and you're just enhancing that. There are some other things that other research that shows that some of the oxides that are present can retain anions, but at this point, the role of natural soils is pretty unclear. And I would say just overall that the whole PFAS partitioning between soil, soil moisture, soil vapor, et cetera, is pretty poorly understood. There's a lot of research being performed now to generate a better understanding overall of how PFAS interact with soil.
That's a really good point. Thanks, Bill. And, you know, to the extent that we have information available, we'll try to incorporate that in the document updates over the next year. And I guess one more question about soils. Will clay-rich soils influence the selection of treatment strategies, and are there technologies that are more effective or maybe less effective in certain types of soil?
Yeah, the grain size is an important factor to look at in evaluating things. Methods. For instance, soil washing is much more effective on coarser grain soils. It is still effective if there's a lot of clays present, but it kind of slows down the process. Maybe you require multiple passes of the material through the washing system. Thermal desorption doesn't really care much about grain size. It just heats it up and drives it off. So, there's a variance in that respect too. And then, the presence of clay could enhance the sorption if you're using stabilization type methods. So really you need to understand that soil chemistry of what you have and take it into account with the different options that are out there.
All right, thanks, Bill. I think I'm gonna try to squeeze in one or two more here. A question for you, Cliff. Are you aware of any case studies that discuss PFAS remediation in wetland environments?
I think Bill touched on this a little bit during his answer to the biological breakdown question and about phytoremediation, and there are some encouraging studies around these topics. For wetlands specifically, I'm not aware of this being done at a field scale. I've seen one study where there was a bacterial strain from a wetland that was cultured in a lab and showed promising results for dechlorinating PFAS, but to my knowledge, this has not been applied in the field. There are also several lab-scale studies under CERDEP that have looked into passive stormwater treatment with a combination of absorption, bioswales, and engineered wetlands. So assessment of this technical approach is advancing rapidly, and we hope that more information will be available in the coming years.
All right, great. Thanks, Cliff. And I guess I'm going to ask my last question here to Bill. Are there data available on the potential diffusion rates of PFAS through HDPE geomembranes? And if so, do different PFAS diffuse at different rates?
Well, there is a little bit of information. There was actually even a paper just published at the end of 2020 related to this question. I think there's also some information from vendors on some vendor websites where they've looked at that a little bit. But overall, the data isn't strong out there in terms of understanding exactly what's happening with those geomembranes. So I think the key is to work with, if you're thinking of using a geomembrane for any purposes, is working with those vendors to understand better what their, what data they have supporting whether diffusion is occurring through there. I would say that paper that I did see just last year mentioned that PFOS and PFOA diffuse through the membranes about 1,000 times slower than for benzene. So there may be other contaminants out there that are, much more mobile, I suppose, through those membranes, and the PFAS might be bound up instead of going through them.
Great. Thanks, Bill. Appreciate that, and hopefully we can grab a link to that paper, make that available in the information that we'll have coming out later the year, and throw that in the digest if we can. I think with that, I'm just looking at the time. Even though we still have a number of questions, we're not going to be able to get through all of them. So I'm going to bring our Q&A to a close, and I want to thank all of our participants today for your questions. We hope this was valuable for you, and we really do appreciate you taking the time out of your busy schedule to join us. And I do want to extend a very special thank you to our panelists for sharing their expertise and for their contributions to the ITRC PFAS team. So I'm just going to flip ahead here. Just as a reminder, on our website, you can find the PFAS Technical and Regulatory Guidance document. If you want to learn a little bit more, we do have those 10 video training modules published on YouTube. You can access those for your use. And as you heard, we are working on our updates to the tech reg. Hopefully, we'll have them published in June and December of this year. We're hoping to continue with our roundtable webinars and some additional outreach. If you've submitted a question that we didn't address in the current document, we will try to incorporate that in our work going forward. And with that, I just am going to close and say thank you again for your participation today. If you have more questions too, please feel free to email us at training@itrcweb.org. We plan to issue a digest of responses to today's questions and any follow-up questions in the next few weeks. We do hope that you'll consider joining us for our roundtable session 4 in June, when our panelists will answer your questions about human and ecological health effects, risk assessment and regulation, stakeholder perspectives, and risk communication. It's going to be jam-packed, but we do hope that you will consider joining us. As you can see on your screen, here's a link to the feedback form. Please use this form to give your comments and any questions you might have for any of our future outreach sessions. So thanks again for joining us, and I hope you all have a wonderful afternoon. Take care. Bye-bye.